I guess how many people today really think that the current version of human society is the most developed and the most advanced? Of course, we cannot blame people for thinking like that, because that's generally what they're taught in the universities, or even if they don't study archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, and the likes at the university. They have faith that those guys at the uni, they know. Of course, if you actually ever study deeply into these matters with a critical eye, you find out that there's much mystery. There's not very much definite knowledge. That's why, in case you ever keep up with the subject matter, you may notice that the dates when human civilization supposedly appeared are always being pushed back. They never come forward. They're always going back more and more. So, how far back shall we get? Recently, on television in the USA, I'm sure the television program will eventually get to New Zealand. It was a special documentary hosted by Charles Heston, presenting all the, shall we say, spectacular archaeological information which is not being made public to people. This was on prime time, and it was opposite a very popular show in the States called 60 Minutes. I think they have some kind of version of that over here. Maybe the same thing, you know. So, in any case, to go up against such a popular show as 60 Minutes is not easy, but still, it was calculated that 50 million people watched this television show, which presented very starkly and with complete documentation how there is just as much evidence to suggest that human beings have existed farther in the past than anyone can calculate. There's just as much evidence to say that as there is for the other view that human beings are a recent development. So right on television they were showing scientific documented evidence of dinosaur footprints right next to human footprints. So it was very, you can imagine it was very jolting for the people in general, because after learning something one way in the educational system, all of a sudden now it's being paraded out in public that, hey gang, it's not actually so. If you've ever seen Charlton Heston in the movies, you know he can be very—he presents things very seriously and soberly, and he's respected as a, you know, fortress of seriousness. So they had him moderating the whole show, and he did just that. And of course, everybody knows also that UFO information is becoming more and more available to the general public. So people are starting to wonder. There's a lot going on that we don't know. There's a lot going on we don't understand. Not only are we finding out that human civilization existed far back into history, far back into time, more than we can even calculate, as opposed to the view we've been taught that human society has been around for a couple thousand years, a few thousand years or more. And also people are finding out there can be such a thing as aliens. In other words, life on other planets, or life forms we're not acquainted with. So these things are starting to become almost mainstream. So we say these things to introduce our study of Bhagavad Gita, because the more you can appreciate that this current version of humanity may not be the culmination of evolution, or the culmination of progress, the more you'll be seeking for another standard of civilization, another standard to try and understand what human beings should be doing. But as long as we remain blinded by the glare of contemporary society, we'll never feel motivated to look for anything different. Just like you're driving along the road at night and someone has their high beams on and they're driving towards you, it blinds you and you cannot see. You may even have to pull over on the side of the road so they pass. That's what it's like when your eyes are full of glare. So it seems that people today, their eyes are full of the glare of society as it is, and it's hard for them to consider that there could be something else. Especially in Western civilization, people have this view that progress is linear, or that development is linear, that you just start from point A, a low level, and move on up to point B, a higher level, and that's the way history moves, straight up. Western culture is based on that kind of conception of linear progress. Things are always moving in a straight line. But you'd be surprised to know that that's not an exclusive view in this world. Everywhere else, people think that human civilization is cyclic, it moves in cycles, just like winter, spring, summer, and fall. In other words, what goes around comes around. That can help us to understand that the present version of society is not the height of some kind of straight line development, but actually it can be the degenerate part of a cycle. This may be. Of course, these things are very crushing for our egos. Perhaps the crisis is going to be as bad as what happened when people found out that the Earth was not the center of the universe. I mean, that was just a few hundred years ago. Caused a great challenge to people's conceptions. What? The Earth is not the center? We human beings are not the center of the universe? Because now that's considered, everybody accepts that. But we've got so many other conceptions which will also be challenged. When will we ever get to the bottom of all this? So anyway, if we have an inkling that there's much more to the story of human civilization on this planet than we're being taught, there's much more to understanding life in this universe than what we're being taught, if we have that kind of understanding, then it's very easy to approach Bhagavad Gita. But if we think that all there is to life is economic development, whether as an individual, whether as a family, or as a society, economic development, and in other words, making money and spending money, work, buy, consume, and then die. If we think that's all there is to life, naturally, it's hard for us to have a desire to consider any other kind of options. And when you are caught in the glare of society as it is now, when the glare of society has overpowered your vision, you can't see anything else but that, then it's naturally you're not very likely to consider other options. So it's a great work, it's a great job to try to reduce the glare that's blinding people's eyes. To try and help one another, no problem. To try and help one another, how to see through all this dense fog. There seems to be so much knowledge people are in such anxiety today. Will my job be, will I be made redundant? Will I be forced to retire early? Will my job be phased out? Will my job exist in the next 5 years? So many of our jobs, which we thought would be around forever, computers are taking quite easily. So everybody has so much anxiety these days. How long will my job last? Am I preparing myself for a lasting career? First, you got to try to find a lasting career. Then, if you think you've found a lasting career, you've got to try to find a company or corporation that will last, or that will allow you to last. Because the trend these days is the more workers that can be done without, the better the corporation is. Downsizing. That's where the prestige is at for managers these days. The less employees you have, the better. You feel very successful if you're an executive, if you're an administrator, and you can tell everyone, yes, we let go about 50% of our work staff last year, getting even more done. Everyone's, wow, what a great manager. What a great executive. Yep. Bought 10 computers, let go 50 clerks. Such a person is very respected today. So people are in such anxiety. What will become of me? Do I have the right skills to last in the future? Am I working for the right corporation? Am I working for the right business? Even in the government. Government service. People are being eased out. Previously, this used to only be the fear of the lower classes. But now, everybody's worried. Persons who thought they were managers with a solid career ahead, job security, they find themselves being moved around without a job, just like a low-salaried worker. So people have so much anxiety today. Where do they put their trust in? And what is the relief or the escape from all this anxiety? Well, at least we can always get intoxicated, go to the cinema. What else can you do? TV is getting better and better. They're bringing more and more shows in from overseas. At least something's happening, right? This is the glare of so-called materialistic, or so-called society, so-called civilization, which is actually very materialistic. All these kinds of influences get in the way of our understanding what actual civilization is. So, with that, we'll start our Friday discovery of Bhagavad Gita. Those of you who have read the back, you know that Bhagavad Gita is revered by many great Western thinkers. Einstein also, he was a great fan of Bhagavad Gita, although it's not listed here. How old is Bhagavad Gita? Well, whose version shall you take? If you go to the university, to the Indology department, the professors will tell you, Bhagavad Gita, a recent Hindu text dating back 200s of years. Actually, however, no one's been able to put a date, a solid date, on the Vedic literature. Now, if you take Bhagavad Gita's version of its own date, then you're for shock. According to Bhagavad Gita, human civilizations that had to write things down are only a recent development. That means, according to Bhagavad Gita, recent means 5,000 years. Only in the last 5,000 years have human beings written things down. And you say, aha, even though 5,000 years is a long time, still it shows that advanced human civilization is a recent development. Even according to the Bhagavad Gita, they weren't writing before 5,000 years ago. No. You'd be shocked to understand that. According to Bhagavad Gita, the reason why no one wrote things down before 5,000 years ago was that their memories were so sharp they could remember everything just by hearing it once. Now, this is something that your scholars have never figured. They think, well, people back then couldn't be any brighter than they are now. So, if they didn't write things down, it means they had no advanced civilization. It's a complete speculation. Whereas the Vedic literatures themselves describe that previous to 5,000 years ago, people could remember something even very complicated just by hearing it once. Nowadays, if you hear that there's like an oral tradition, it sounds like something from some indigenous people, some aborigines, passing things down by hearing. You know, it's not very advanced. There's nothing like having a computer and it's all there on your hard drive, your floppy disk. That's where it's really at. Now, in the best civilizations, the most complicated or intense philosophical ideas could be understood just by hearing once. And people could repeat to others without distorting. But this is all so hard for us to accept these days. Anyway, so let me start in. First we do our invocation. That's on page 1. This is a Sanskrit invocation to make an auspicious atmosphere in our gathering here. Sound can pollute, and sound can also purify and elevate. So although you won't understand the words, everyone here, myself included, will certainly benefit by hearing them. So we'll just recite some of these mantras. Takes a few minutes. And then we'll go straight to our study. Om Jnana Timirangasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yudhaparakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagnaradinatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Sha. Hey Krishna Karna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Sapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakopatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sia Dwaita Gadadha Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Tonight, why don't we turn to chapter 9, called The Most Confidential Knowledge, text number 2. That's page 449. How's the temperature here? Is it cool, hot, warm, comfortable? Anyone else like some air? Anyone else like some air? Okay. This is a very famous verse from Bhagavad Gita, and it's good for us to focus on it because it kind of separates the conception of what we consider religion from the conception of real spiritual understanding. Now, when we talk about religion, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Without reading this verse, don't read it. God. Okay.
Groups of people
congregating
together.
God. What would you say?
Oh, some people dressed up with fancy clothes.
And you?
Creator.
Host to God. God. An institution of rules and restrictions.
Would you think? I think church
with heaps of gold and
gold. Church with heaps of what? Like heaps of glamour and gold and gold.
Okay. What would you say?
Yeah, churches.
Churches.
Mm-hmm.
Group of people believing in a God. Mm-hmm.
Philosophy.
What would you say? When you think of the word religion, I mean.
Just worshiping something you believe in.
Worshiping something you believe in. Mm-hmm. What would you say?
Something like boredom, ritual,
What would you say?
Some beliefs, some rules.
Spiritual.
Okay. Yes. Generally, you'll find if you ask people what they think religion refers to, that word, some kind of God, whatever that may be, however you define it. Many people will say, as she did, a set of rules and regulations restricting you. Many people will give the same visual descriptions you gave, groups of people coming together and engaging in rituals and in buildings known as churches, doing things that have been organized for them by others. So generally it sounds like religion's a pretty unattractive thing. And certainly according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, what people today think is religion is definitely unattractive. A main problem that we have is that it's about this thing called belief. Everybody's got a right to have their own beliefs. You believe this, I believe that, whatever. God is whatever you make God out to be. Actually, you might want to consider that as long as the individual human being or any creature that minute. As long as any living entity puts himself or herself in the role of deciding everything and being the arbiter, then basically you are saying that I am the controller, I am the absolute standard. This is a very important point to understand, because as long as we're doing like that, according to Bhagavad Gita, there can be no understanding of spirituality. We'll talk more about that later, because it might sound a bit uncomfortable. In fact, it seems very comfortable these days to think that we are the ultimate judge. I'm the captain of my ship, the master of my fate. I decide what is and what isn't. Seems very exhilarating and very liberating. But we have to look at the facts. It'd be an interesting point to try and understand how independent are we? In other words, are we simply thinking we're independent, but actually our hands and feet are bound up tightly? Or maybe we really are independent. In other words, to actually understand what spirituality is, we have to start to deal with, am I all powerful or am I under some other power? These are the issues of real spirituality. And because people aren't being put in contact with these issues, they find the so-called religion is very unpalatable. And then we, of course, get to the point about rules and regulations that restrict you. Regardless of what people are being told they have to do in various churches and so on and so forth, there's no doubt that human life means restriction. You just can't do everything you want to do. And you shouldn't do everything you want to do. That means there's some kind of standard, some kind of guidelines. If some animal is running around in the forest, biting this and digging up the ground, everybody just says, oh, well, it's an animal. But human beings, they're not supposed to do that. Human beings are supposed to follow some kind of regulation. Of course, the question is, where does the regulation come from? Who decides what is the regulation? That's the real problem here. But we have to agree that as human beings, it's obvious we cannot just run around and do whatever we like whenever we feel. Just like some dog on the street. Dog sees something it wants to eat, it just runs and eats it. If it sees a female dog it wants, then it goes to the female dog. Its tongue is always hanging out of his mouth, walking, scurrying down the street. No rules, no regulations. Now, if that is the goal of life, then we're obviously competing with the dogs. A life of no regulations. So we shouldn't have a kind of grudge against restriction and regulation. Because a lot of restrictions and regulations may be for the point of making us healthy. Just like if you're sick, you can't eat certain things. You can't do certain things. Why? You accept that kind of restriction so you can become healthy. Similarly, there are, in any bona fide spiritual system, there are restrictions in order that our real health develops. Now, to understand that point, we've got to understand what real pleasure is. Because everybody wants pleasure. So therefore, if you hear about restrictions that you feel are getting in the way of your real pleasure, then you don't like it. But the whole issue may be, what is real pleasure? So if we understand what real pleasure is, we won't mind restrictions that are meant to safeguard the real pleasure. But if we don't understand what real pleasure is, we can't understand why there should be restriction on our behavior. Seems like, so-called religious regulations are ruining all the fun, you know? But if we understand what real pleasure is, then we can see, yes, by refraining from the lower tastes, I leave myself open for the higher tastes. But because people aren't being taught that in their so-called religions, therefore, the whole thing seems like a burden to them. And no one likes to have some trick laid on them by somebody else. Who are you to set yourself on high, set yourself up on high, say you're a priest, or this or that, you're going to tell me how to live? Nobody likes that. So how do we decide how to live? Well, each person's got to work that out for himself or herself, the best you can. But that means you're accepting yourself as the ultimate judge and standard. Now, does that really hold up? Well, that we have to decide. All these things are being said to help us kind of ease our way into Bhagavad Gita. All right, we'll look at text 2. I'll just recite the Sanskrit and then we can go right to the English. Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pajaksha Avagamam Dharyam Susukam Kartam Avyayam. I'd like to read the translation, anyway? Yes, loudly, please.
This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed.
Very good. All right, you have these points written on the whiteboard here. All of these points, now, I should remind you, are essential for us to understand what real pleasure is. No one here has anything against real pleasure. Certainly, no one here would mind hearing some pointers about real pleasure. Of course, most of us think, yeah, I know what pleasure is. We may be in for a shock, though. So much of our knowledge, or even all of our knowledge about what we think is pleasure, may simply be in relation to the temporary body and mind. In other words, we don't know anything about spiritual pleasure because we don't know anything about the real identity. Anyway, the king of knowledge, in Sanskrit, that is known as Raja Vidya. Raja means king, Vidya means knowledge. There's so many branches of knowledge. People are studying so many different things. Obviously, it seems, you got to really work out what you're going to learn. What's the best thing to learn? Especially nowadays, it's supposed to be the information age. What are you going to study? What's the best thing you can learn? You've only got so many years in life, you know? So right from the start, in the beginning of this text, Bhagavad Gita is telling you, Raja Vidya, go for the king of knowledge. Go for the king of education. The king of knowledge is about what is eternal, what is lasting. There's so many branches of knowledge for studying temporary things, temporary affairs, temporary situations, temporary bodies, temporary minds. But to be the king of knowledge, to study the king of knowledge means to find out what is eternal and study that. Find out that which has no beginning and no end. Once you start doing that, then you're ready to start dealing with what is real pleasure. Why is that? Because real pleasure has no beginning and no end. That's why we get so frustrated with the so-called pleasure of our lives. It all has a beginning and end. Not only that, I was talking just in Sydney 2 nights ago. I asked everyone, just think about your favorite pleasure. Don't say what it is now. Just think about it. Whatever your favorite pleasure is, rock climbing, going to rave parties, or whatever. Can you do it non-stop? day and night, week after week. Think of it, whatever it is. Dare say, even the intimate affairs between man and woman, the most sacred religious activities. Day and night, nonstop, week after week. No, you go crazy. You want to strangle your beloved partner. You will. It's not possible. Now, what people do instead, they don't just say, "I need a break from you." They just say, "I think I'll take an evening course at the uni." They come up with some excuse to diversify their life. I think I'll be visiting my girlfriends tonight. In other words, I want to get away from you. I think I'll be visiting mother. In this way, everybody tries to fill their life with so many different kinds of things because there's not one thing they can do all the time without going nuts. Try it. You want to experiment? Try it. You like to surf? Try surfing. Day in, day out. Week after week after week. Try it. You like partying? Anyone try nonstop partying? You like smoking marijuana? Drinking? Do it nonstop. It's really amazing when you analyze that way. Your favorite activity, your most cherished activity, you cannot do it all the time without going nuts. That shows you something about what is real pleasure. Here we are thinking we are the great experts in pleasure. But there's not one thing that we can do all the time. Just try going to the cinema nonstop. Watching television nonstop. Playing rugby nonstop. Watching rugby nonstop. Oh, going to a U2 concert or something. Try doing it night after night after night after night. The musicians can't play nonstop without going crazy, and you can't listen to them nonstop without going crazy. Everything is like that. So according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, this is not real pleasure. You cannot do it all the time. That's why you always have to juggle all these different activities. A little bit of liquor here, cinema there, girlfriend here, rugby there. Now I want to be alone. Now I want to be around my friends. Now I'll visit my family. Now I'm tired of my family. Now I'll do this. Now I'll do that. I'll get this job. Now time to train up for another career. This. Tired of Auckland. I'll fly to Sydney. Tired of Sydney. I'll fly to Paris. And this way. I need a relationship. You establish a relationship with this one. Oh, but now I need another one. Oh, but maybe I should go back to the original one. Or maybe I should have them both at the same time. This way. You juggle, 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 juggle. Where is the real pleasure? I know. I guess it's time to stop taking those pills. I'll have a kid. That'll do it. That'll bring some more zest into our relationship. Well, that didn't really give me lasting satisfaction. I know. The kid needs another kid to play with. I have another kid. In this way, we try this, we try that. All kinds of ways. We try to be the enjoyer and creator. And nothing touches the spot. Nothing hits the spot. It seems to be so fascinating. And then it disappoints us, as always. So this shows us, if we cannot find one thing we can do all the time, you may like to study. You can't do it all the time. Not possible. You may like to drive. You can't do it all the time. That shows you what's really going on. We don't know what real pleasure is, although we think we are so expert. We're so concerned. Am I getting all that I should be getting out of life? You go buy so many books, how to have better intimate relations, how to have a better career, how to do this, how to do that. You're always watching your peers. making sure nobody else is getting more pleasure than you. But anxiety. And you think, almost everyone else is so happy, it's only me who's not getting all that I should be getting. So, once again, real pleasure means no question of beginning or end. In fact, spiritual pleasure means it doesn't even stay the same. It's always increasing at every moment, dynamic. That is what Krishna is explaining in the Bhagavad Gita as real pleasure. Not only does real pleasure have no beginning and no end, but it doesn't even remain the same. It's always dynamically increasing.
Impossible.
Yeah? How do we know?
How do we know?
That's why we need educational material like Bhagavad Gita to teach us what is possible and what exists, although we don't know it. So that is the king of education. The king of all subject matters is about pleasure that has no beginning and end. To get that kind of pleasure, we've got to understand we're not the body. Of course, it's getting more and more popular these days to accept that you're not the body. A lot of people go around talking about reincarnation. Yeah, my past life, I must have been a fish because I just like to swim. Well, in my past life, I must have been a pigeon because I just have to have a lot of, you know, a lot of girlfriends, a lot of boyfriends. Yeah, I don't know how to go like that. If you're toying with understanding reincarnation, more specifically known in the Vedic text as transmigration, that means you're actually toying, whether you know it or not, with the understanding that your identity is not simply the body. In other words, when the body ends, there's something about you that still goes on. So it's probably best that we do more than toy with these concepts. We actually got to find out what's going on. We've got everything to gain and nothing to lose. That's the best kind of gamble, you know? Let me try to find out if I have an eternal aspect of my existence. If I fail in that search, what have I lost? I was going to die anyway. And if I win, hey, I'm really into something. So you got everything to gain, nothing to lose. That's the way a real gambler thinks. This is the real gamble. Everything to gain, nothing to lose. How do you like those odds? You won't find that in any casino. All win, no loss. Even if you think, if I take up spiritual quest, if I start really paying attention to Bhagavad Gita and listening to Krishna, it could just all be a waste of time. In that case, though, our time is going to be wasted anyway, because death comes and finishes everything. Death proves that whatever you did is a waste of time in terms of material activities, because you can't take it with you past death. So you're going to lose anyway. But if you win, if you can experience your spiritual identity. Wonderful, wonderful odds. The king of education. How to understand eternal pleasure and the eternal self. Now, we go to the next concept, the most confidential, number two. Why is this kind of talk as we're having today the most confidential? Because ordinary people are not interested in these things. They think, what has this got to do with putting more money in my bank account? What has this got to do with increasing my sensual stimulation? I've got no time for all these subject matters. Why should I care about these things? I can't see any spirit soul. I can't see any supreme spirit. Why should I care? Because that is the attitude of the ordinary person. Therefore, the instructions given in Bhagavad Gita are called Rajaguhyam, the most confidential. But there's another reason why it's considered to be so confidential. And that is, simply to understand that you are spirit is not enough. The most confidential thing to understand is, what does a spirit soul do? Until you understand that, until we understand that, we're not really going to take up any kind of spiritual lifestyle in the true sense. Well, we'll use the word spirituality and spiritual things. But in terms of actually transforming our lifestyle, we won't do that unless we can... That's because this most confidential knowledge of the qualities and activities of the pure soul is not known. It's the most confidential. So we have a problem today. People are not up to the level of understanding that they're spirit, but that's just the beginning. Even if they do understand that, they've got to understand, what does a spirit soul do? How do you exist as spirit soul? Once they understand that, then you can start getting into what real pleasure is. So once again, Rajaguhyam, the most confidential. Then, any questions at this point about any talk, anything, please?
So, to be able to understand your spirit or what it is or what it does, you must read the book in the Bhagavad Gita.
Certainly, there is no better source of information, precise, clear, authoritative. Now, a lot of people don't like, you know, we don't like to hear that. I know, you're saying, your book is the only book. Now, Bhagavad Gita is not the only book. If you go to Wickalls and you want a dictionary, you'll find dictionaries of different sizes. It's not that the pocket dictionary that fits in your purse, it's not that it's wrong. It just doesn't contain as much expansive information as the unabridged dictionary. So Bhagavad Gita is like the unabridged dictionary. It contains a lot of things that are in other spiritual texts, and a lot that's not another spiritual text. So he's actually pushing me now. He's pushing me to... What is the advantage in hearing Bhagavad Gita? There's so many books. I mean, if we're going to take up the contemporary attitude, well, you've got your opinion, I've got mine. This book says this, that book says that, whatever, you know, whatever gets you off, whatever gets you over, you know. So how would you answer that? What do you think the advantage, and what do you think the advantage would be in hearing Bhagavad Gita?
Well, I don't know.
Instead of me answering, I'll ask you to answer.
Well, I haven't read it.
No, that's
what I mean. What do you see as the difference between Bhagavad Gita and other spiritual books or other religious books?
No, I'll ask you, what might, even though you haven't read it, what would you hope for is the difference? Or what do you think the difference should be?
Well, I mean, I'm just looking to find out about my if I have a spirit or what it does to me, these things. I don't know. I'm open-minded still.
But still, you must have some idea of what you'd like, what you'd hope the difference is. You sound like you're from Sweden?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. From where?
In Stockholm.
Oh, Stockholm. I used to live in Södertälje.
I suppose I want to find out, I think there's something else in this world that we see, and mm-hmm. I want to find out how you can find out about that world, and how you can get the eternal pleasure or whatever.
I see. Okay, so what is your name?
John.
So John from Sweden, Sweg, he's said that. Now, why don't you all answer that point? What would you say to him? I guess I'd do all the talking. Actually, what would you?
Let's see.
He's told you what his reasons for wanting to hear about Bhagavad Gita are. And what would you tell him?
I mean, don't, you know, it's feel. Let's see.
I'd say it's got, like, a lot of different methods, and every chapter is just a different method to find out what John is asking about. So it's kind of comprehensive, Gita's comprehension. Compared to other books.
You read it?
Why is that for life?
There we are. Have it.
You read it?
Well, I've read probably familiar with four or five chapters.
You've read from chapter 1 to 5.
This Kali Yoga Jhana.
You kind of pick different chapters.
Yeah.
All right, so.
Anyway, what were you going to say? Say what you want. I mean, no, how would you answer his question? There's no company line here.
To me, it really stands out compared to, like, the Bible. I've read the Bible, and I've read parts of the Quran. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but it's far ahead.
Well, I'm aware of that.
It's much different than the Bible. It's just got direct insights that hit me directly more than, I don't know, I wouldn't want to say the Bible's superficial, but it's just a bit different.
Yeah. How much of it have you read, if I may ask?
Well, when I was younger, we went through it slowly. I've read parts of it since.
Well, let's let others. Anyone else would like to?
I can just say from my experience that once you start on a spiritual quest, you sort of put out a thought form, and automatically you're drawn to spiritual teachers and later on. So once you start, you know, you've got that thought there that becomes automatic.
Which thought?
Well, a spiritual quest, or like a spiritual plan.
You know, I had an experience once when I went to New York City. Is it New York City? Yeah, if you ever go to New York City, a place called Times Square, you heard about that? And there's all sorts of guys that will come up to you and try to sell you gold watches. You know, especially they look for foreigners or people from out of town. They call you know, reach into their coat, gold Rolex watch, special price for you. And no. You'll look, you're curious. Yeah, Rolex watch for just $100. Wow. And then you walk up, you know, 10 steps down the street, someone else. Gold Rolex watch. And but you know, after 10 people come up to you like that, Rolex watch. Yeah, maybe I really need one, and I wonder if these watches are good, and anyone wants $100, you know, it could be something really a great deal. And of course, many people do buy. Many people get cheated. They feel they need a watch, but because they don't understand what real gold is, they're cheated. So simply to have a desire, let me find gold, doesn't mean you're going to find gold. Someone will come up to you with some yellow metal, and here's gold. Yes, yes, my intuition told me to seek out gold. Someone came right up to me with some gold. Let me take it. So you take it, and you pay your money. It turns out just to be worthless. In other words, what I'm saying is that Bhagavad Gita, one thing that you may have not presented to John, which I'd like to present, if you don't mind, is that Bhagavad Gita will give you the real thing simultaneously with training you how to recognize the real thing. Now that is quite an accomplishment. It'll build your discrimination. It'll train you in the ability to discriminate reality from illusion while at the same time giving you reality. That's quite a feat. Training you to be objective while giving you the supreme subjective experience. That is the real wonder of Bhagavad Gita. It just doesn't say, believe this, believe that. No. In fact, we're jumping now to point four, direct perception of the self. Real spirituality, as is said these days, it's not a question of a belief that sits on top of your head. It's a question of what are you and how should you act? If you're spiritual, what do you do? What's the difference between a spiritual acting person and a non-spiritually acting person? And what are the activities of the pure spirit soul when it's not in a material body? These things we need to know. In other words, yeah, I'm spiritual. I'm starting to understand that. I've read Celestine Prophecy, Deepak Chopra, all these other books. I'm starting to realize I'm spiritual. But what are you doing in this body? Do you need this body? A lot of people say, yeah, we have to have this body, even though we're spiritual, because we've got to go through lessons, we've got to learn. Do you have to? Does the spirit soul need a temporary body of matter? How did you get the body in the first place? These are points that Bhagavad Gita deals with. And it just doesn't push it down your throat in a dogmatic way. It trains you in discrimination and analysis while simultaneously presenting the real thing. In other words, simply to have your mind trained in discrimination before you can deal with the real thing, that can be, kind of dry and boring. But if it happens while you're actually... If I hand you gold in your hand, simultaneously with teaching you how to recognize real gold, that's very advantageous. Whereas if I just say, John, come to my course in how to recognize gold, you'll say, yeah, that could do me a lot of good. I should learn how to recognize gold. But in your heart, you're thinking, but where is the gold? But if I say, John, come to my class, and I'm going to do two things to you at once. I'm going to give you gold and teach you what is real gold at the same time. So, well, yes. That's what Bhagavad Gita does. But there's a problem people have with Bhagavad Gita. What do you think that problem is?
Difference between the Bible and Bhagavad Gita. The Bible doesn't talk enough about, the philosophy or what life is all about and what the spiritual world might be like.
Too philosophical, people might find that a problem. Well, Bhagavad Gita says itself that it's Rajaguhya, the most confidential. It's not meant for people with ordinary interests. Another problem, Mike.
Or it could be based on religion. Based on religion, Hindu religion.
Can you explain?
I don't know. I mean, Krishna is Hinduism. I haven't read this thing, so I don't know anything about it.
What is Hindu, anyway?
I have no idea, man. I'm here to learn.
Then that's a great definition of Hinduism. No idea. That's the most honest definition of Hinduism.
Yeah, but you talk about religion, people... pulled back from religion because it's a set of rules, it's a code of conduct, it's a mode of behavior. And I think because Lord Krishna is supposed to be Hindu god, people may not like this because it's based on religion. So that's what I'm saying, I think.
But isn't the Bible based on religion?
Now, what he's saying, now he's introduced something, we should deal with that, this concept of Hindu. And I asked him, what does Hindu mean? And he said, I have no idea. And I told him, that's actually the most honest definition of Hinduism. No idea. Or another way of defining Hinduism is anything that goes on there in India, that's east of Pakistan and west of Bangladesh, that's Hinduism. Anything from worshipping snakes to riding on magic carpets or pressing your nose or whatever. It's all Hinduism. Bhagavad Gita, you'll be very interested to know, has nothing to do with Hinduism. Do you know where the word Hindu comes from? Separating, more or less, Pakistan from India. Not separating, but somewhere near. There's the Sindhu River. And now, the people on the west side of that river, they could not say S sound. So when they referred to the people on the other side of the river, they couldn't say Sindhu. They said, those Hindus over there on the other side of the Hindu river. And so the name stuck. It was just like Kiwi. You know, the world's full of these kind of labels. Kiwis, Aussies, Yanks. Hindus. It's the same thing. So, Bhagavad Gita has nothing to do with Hinduism. Hinduism is just a term, you know, like Kiwi or Aussie. Bhagavad Gita is concerned with what is known in Sanskrit as Sanatana Dharma, the eternal characteristics of the living entity. In other words, sugar, what is its characteristic? It's sweet. Water, wet. What is the eternal nature of the spirit soul? That is what Bhagavad Gita is concerned with. Now, still, what is the advantage in hearing from Bhagavad Gita? Or, I think we put it the other way. Actually, the advantage is seen by others as the disadvantage. Now, what do you think the disadvantage, what do you think people might think the disadvantage is? Or the rub?
Well, that you have to do certain things in order to get what you want. You have to do certain things, and maybe they don't like doing.
Oh, can you give an example?
Well, the meditation or chanting or getting up really early to say prayers or particular types of service that may not agree with you.
So, is anybody in this room? Is there anybody in this room who never has to do something that they don't want to do? Anyone?
Nobody has to do anything.
Really?
If they choose not to.
Really? There's no... When you say that, are you implying that there's nothing to... There's no reaction if you refuse to do something? Or if you do something that you're not supposed to do?
No, but there's a choice there. There's still an element of choice.
Ooh. Okay. About everything. Do you remember when you were 2 years old? Do you remember when you were 4 years old?
Sometimes.
8 years old? 15. 20. Did you want to get old?
Didn't really bother me.
But...
She's trying.
You want to get older?
I want. It's a process that everyone has to go through.
Everyone has to go through? Oh, indeed. I thought we had a choice about everything. No one has to do anything.
Well, I mean, she's right in many ways. I mean, if you don't want to do anything, you just sit there and then you don't get old and you die.
Try to stop your old age. Try to stop your death.
Yeah, if you don't die, yeah, you get old.
And you will die.
Yeah, sooner or later.
Right. So, that's nature's way of showing you. You're not in control. After all is said and done, you cannot stop your aging or your death. No matter what Deepak Chopra says. You can't stop your aging. he's getting older while he's writing books. You can stop your aging. He's aging. But people are buying me.
Maybe he's taking you away.
Huh? That's another thing. I did not get into that.
Well, this is what you're saying.
No. I just pointed out that even, and that everybody ages, it may be very slow, just like there are yogis who can make their life very long by practically stopping their breathing. You see, according to the Ayurveda, lifespan is measured in terms of breath. So if you slow your breathing down, then your life is longer. But actually, it's not that your life is longer, because according to the Ayurveda, the actual lifespan is the breath. It's not time. But to us, we think, oh, he reduced his breathing, and therefore he made his life longer. When actually the length of the life is measured in the breath, not time. So, yogis, they can... That's why a big part of hatha yoga is to slow your breathing down. That means your life is longer from one point of view. And the quicker you breathe, it means your life is shorter. But it's not really that you're making your life longer or shorter, because the actual lifespan itself is bound up to the rate of your breathing. In other words, the Vedas teach you that everyone is allotted a certain amount of breaths. Now, it's up to you how quickly you take those breaths, or how slowly you take those breaths. But the amount of breaths is already allotted according to your karma, your activities from your past life. That's why to practice yoga, the first thing that's required to practice classical yoga is celibacy.
Oh, God forbid.
Why is that? Because during the sexual relations, the breathing is very quick, and that means one's life is going. So that's the first thing yogis do. They curtail that activity. And then they go to the Himalayas on top of a mountain, and they try to slow their breathing down practically to nothing. And that way, if you know where to look, if you go in the Himalayas, you'll find easily. Yogis have been around for 300 years. No big deal. No big deal. They know. The lifespan is measured in the breath. Still, they do get old, and they still die. This is a very important point, because it shows how we are completely not independent, although we think we are independent. We're bound up. Bhagavad Gita will teach us that we're bound up by the laws of nature in terms of birth, old age, disease, and death. These are like shackles. And you can't cut these shackles through material methods. So once again, what would be the disadvantage in hearing Bhagavad Gita?
Well, you just said it, haven't you, that you may have to give up the material parts of your life, material opulence, material enjoyment, the worldly enjoyment of life, and so forth. That may be the right thing you got.
But that's going to give you up anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not absolute. I mean, it's not an absolute way of living.
What do you mean?
Yeah, well, I got holes in it, like everything else.
What's that?
I got holes in it. Sorry.
What's got holes in it?
Yeah, the book, or I mean the way of living that the book might encourage.
Holds it? Yeah, I don't understand.
Yeah, well, you know, you often look for something else, and then you find something that you really like, but then kind of the more you discover about it, the more you find out that it actually got the kind of the whole Senate. But
oh, you mean?
It's not absolute. It's not like.
Oh, that sounds like.
It, you know?
Sounds like a good girlfriend. When you first meet her, she's the whole. She's everything.
Yeah,
and as you get to know her, you see all the faults.
Right.
Or vice versa, yeah.
Yeah.
And when you first meet her or him, you know, it's this magic moment. But then, you know, shortly thereafter, a few weeks, a few months, or years, you know, the thrill is gone. Now, what you're saying is a good point, but it's, the answer to that is bound up in what some people see as the disadvantage to Bhagavad Gita, and others would see as the advantage. Some people see the disadvantage is that it's spoken so clearly and so definitively. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the origin of everything material and spiritual. Everything emanates from me. It's presenting a supreme arbiter, a supreme controller. And in it, in Bhagavad Gita, it's very clear that we are controlled. We are very tiny, finite, limited. And Krishna is unlimited, infinite. So, we may not like that. Although, if we just look at our life, we see, I cannot stop my old age, I cannot stop death, how tiny and insignificant I am. But, unfortunately, a lot of people, they like to read so-called spiritual books about, you are the everything, you are the unlimited, there's no limits, just think that there are no limits, and there are no limits. Meanwhile, as they're reading, they're getting older. And sometimes we can't even digest the food that we're eating, and we're thinking, I'm unlimited. And then, while we're reading books about how we are unlimited, our girlfriend or boyfriend says, bye-bye, I like somebody else. wait a minute, I'm unlimited. I am the everything. We are so tiny and insignificant. It takes humility to read Bhagavad Gita, that's the problem. It dashes to bits our dream of becoming the Supreme. How can you become the Supreme? Just the fact that you have to become means you aren't. But Bhagavad Gita teaches that you can share the same pleasure as the Supreme. Partners in pleasure. But one partner is finite, the other is infinite. Qualitatively, you can have the same existence as Krishna, but not quantitative. Impossible. And what's the proof of our quantitative difference? The quantitative difference between us and Krishna? The proof is, here we are, trapped in material bodies in a temporary world. Like sparks that have jumped out of a fire. Whereas the fire itself, generally speaking, is not in danger of being extinguished, but when the sparks jump out of the sparks lose their fiery nature. Because the sparks are so tiny, but the fire is big. So the advantage in hearing from Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is that you're hearing directly from the source of all energies. Otherwise, we can all go around saying, well, you've got your opinion, I've got mine. It's whatever you think is all right. Whatever you think is all right. It's just all whatever. That's okay, maybe, for us to say, but once we realize there's a source of all energy, and we take our information from that source, then we are getting the perfect knowledge. How many of you have been to Stockholm? Only John. You've been? Huh?
Been here.
All right, John, anyone else? So, have you been to Södertälje yet? No, I didn't use that. All right. It's 40 kilometers outside of Stockholm. All right. So, anyway. You have not been to Stockholm. But if you hear from John about Stockholm, you'll feel secure. It's like if some of you had some travel plans to go to Stockholm. You feel very fortunate to meet someone from Stockholm. You'd ask them, where are the best places to stay? we're the best this, we're the best that. You feel very happy, and you go back to your friends, really lucked out. I met someone from Stockholm. He gave me all the pointers on what to do in Stockholm. You'd be so happy. I used to talk to a lot of backpackers in Malaysia. Malaysia's on the backpacker route between Indonesia and Thailand. And so they would be so happy if they could just meet somebody who would give them information about a place they were going to. What luck, travelers, what? I met someone from such and such, from Perth, and they told me a place where I can really eat cheaply. Oh, I'm so happy.
Hare Krishna.
So, the advantage of getting it from Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is that you're getting it from the source. From the source, everything proceeds. Therefore, when you hear from Krishna, you can know about everything.
I think
anything you all might want to add or subtract or multiply?
Do we hear all this?
We did most of it. We never get to the bottom. I always make these lists, and we never get to the end of it.
Isn't there to get to what you're seeking here, you have to forego or give up material parts of living. I know I raised it before, but that's what I have read in the introduction.
Like what? What do you think you have to... Well, you tell me. What do you think you have to give up?
Well, the material wonders of this world.
Like what? What are those wonders?
House, cars, money, clothes.
Are you sure those are the wonders?
Well, I don't know. Those are the things we need. Okay, those are the things we need.
Are you sure we need?
Well, I need some ice. It's pretty cold. But seriously...
Well, is that a wonder of the world? Clothes?
Seriously, I see the difference in the introduction I read to achieve this spiritual...
Mm-hmm.
Spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
The temporary material goods you sort of forego or do not seek to aspire to.
What do you think you would lose? What do you think you have to lose?
You know, I'm asking a question. Is that a major difference in the philosophy that is in this book?
I'm asking you a question. What do you think you'd lose? Or what do you have to lose? That's a better question. What do you have to lose? Okay, now we're getting close here. What do you have to lose?
I think most people here are for one reason, because they're attracted to whatever this is teaching. So I think our answer will be that we will gain something, which is spiritual satisfaction and not the anxieties, worries, distresses, or the mortgage or holidays or whatever. Is that answer?
All right, but if you don't want to, but still, I'd be interested in your views on what you think you'd lose or what others might think they would lose. Specific.
By reading this.
It must be a real powerful book. It makes you lose everything. You tell me. You tell me.
I don't know. I can't think of what I would lose.
All right, we'll look at... Perhaps we can look at your point a different way. You know the popular saying, you come into this world with nothing and you leave with nothing. So actually, what do you have to lose? What is it that's yours anyway? You come in with nothing, you leave with nothing, and in between birth and death, you madly run around and say, this is mine, you're mine, you belong to me, this belongs to me. That's life. That's what the people say. You actually have nothing to give up. Nothing belongs to us. Even our very bodies have been supplied by nature. We didn't even create our own bodies. We simply have our desires, which have brought us into certain situations, but we haven't created the bodies and we haven't created the situations. So what is there to give up? only the illusion that we have something. This is mine, you are mine. People do that individually, and they also do that collectively. That's what nationalism is, or nationhood. There's individual selfishness, this is for me, and then there's national selfishness. This is for our country. Our country shall enjoy, the other countries shall suffer. That's just collective selfishness. And then there's species selfishness. The human beings should all benefit. Well, the human beings are just a fraction of all the species of life on the planet. Okay, we'll get really into deep ecology. All the species on Earth should benefit. But this Earth is just one speck out of countless planets. Okay, the whole universe should benefit. But this universe is just one speck out of infinite universes. Not infinite, but seems like infinite. You can't count them all. All this is described in the Vedic literatures. And the total material experience with its universes that you can't count, that's just a fraction of reality. The material realm is a tiny portion of everything. The vast majority of existence is a spiritual world, the spiritual realm, where things have no beginning and no end. So once again, what do we have to give up? That is an essential part of education, to realize we have nothing to give up. But in illusion, we are thinking, this is mine, I, me, and mine. So once you realize that, then you see that there are no barriers to real pleasure. Because we actually want pleasure. That's why we want things and we want people. We want the pleasure. Now if we can learn that we don't get the best pleasure in that way, that there's better ways to get pleasure, then we'll make an adjustment. That's why, in conclusion, because it's time for dinner, we'll hopefully put you to rest in peace with this information from Krishna in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Page 147, please. The grand finale. Page 147. Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, contents of the Gita summarized. Text 59. Vishaya vinivartante nirahadasya jainina rasavajam rasopyasya paranjaspana vartante. Who would like to read the translation? You can.
The embodied soul may be restricted for sense engagement, though the tasteful sense of the mind, but seizing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness.
Okay. Very educational, huh? Yes. In other words, Krishna is telling you in advance, even if you understand the illusion of material life, you won't be able to give it up without getting the superior pleasure. On that note, we shall end. Thank you all very much for your participation and illumination. You're all welcome to have dinner, those who desire. All right. You're just going through some complexities, that's wrong. And you don't want to take any advice about it, you want to kind of hack your way through it yourself. So I'm not interfering with that. And that bothers you. That bothers you.
When did this happen? Is it really interesting or really
weighted? I'm not saying
it. I think everything is personal. There are certain things you're battling with, and I can't resolve them. Because you don't want that.
My wife is.
So you have to deal with it yourself.
Sure, maybe so.
until you get tired of it. And when you get tired of it, then ask me, okay?
Select group of people.
I know, because you're a combination of rebelliousness and submissiveness. And so you rebel halfway, then you submit halfway, then you rebel again. So when you get tired of it, you let me know, and I can help you. Fair enough? Oh, please have a seat. That's why the king of knowledge, you've got to find the top. So Bhagavad Gita will give you the top and teach you simultaneously how to recognize the top.
Yeah.
Knowledge of the Supreme as the Creator is not the top. Knowledge of the Supreme as the Enjoyer is the top.
Someone created enjoyment.
Yeah. But the activity of creation is not the topmost activity of the Supreme. The topmost activity of the Supreme is enjoying the very thing that we think we're expert at, but fail so miserably at. That's like saying you just can't be healthy, you got to get sick. So what you're saying is, why be healthy all the time? You got to get some diseases in order to be well balanced. So what you're saying is that we just can't be pure, we've just got to...
Maybe the Greeks say, well, I'm saying, everyone goes through in their life, everyone has the sun,
you see it.
That's human nature.
Are you sure? You study that?
And then I've got a book...
That's the material nature, you're right, but it's not our real nature.
But even in your mind, you could send, you know, even in your language.
Right. So, but then, are you the body or are you the mind? That's what you have to figure out. What's that? What does spirit do? You've got to find it out. Right, so therefore the most confidential knowledge, point two, is the activity of the spirit soul. What does the spirit soul do? You need to find that out, otherwise you'll never lose your imprisonment. You never get free from your imprisonment in material life until you find out the all attractiveness of the spiritual life. Otherwise, you just go around saying, hey, I'm spiritual, I'm spiritual. But what does that mean, you know? It's all talk. You've got to get to, you may have some little experience, I may have some little experience, but we've got to find out what the real standard is.
Huh?
The real standard that is spoken by the source of everything. It didn't bug me yet. It's like this, it's like that.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree that a lot of people do have the kind of material values to express themselves.
Excuse me, what is your name?
Devamrita Swami. Devamrita Swami.
Do Hare Krishna have yoga any day of the week?
Have what?
Yoga.
We do yoga all the time.
Yeah, but you have a special session when...
Oh, you mean physical yoga?
That's our name.
We may do it on our own, but we don't teach it. I mean, it's good for the body, but we're not, you should keep your machine in shape, you know, but you're not the machine.
I haven't been for about 2 or 3 years.
Since how long have you been in this Lord Krishna?
What do you think?
Because you already learned
first. What do you... Take a guess.
Because you...
Take a guess.
Take a guess, I can't guess, but...
Take a speculation.
10 years? 10 years.
Maybe 10 years.
You're right.
How many?
25.
How many?
25 years.
God, you're a young man too.
How old are you?
How old is the body?
Yeah.